Chapter 3. Adolf Bethke has sold his house and come to live in the town. After he took his wife back to live with him again, all went well for a while. He did his work, she did hers, and it looked as if things would be all right again. Then the village began to whisper. When his wife would go down the street in the evening, voices would call after her. Young men meeting her would laugh impudently to her face. Women gathered up their skirts with pointed gestures. His wife never mentioned these things to Adolf, but she wilted under it and grew daily paler. With Adolf, it was the same. If he went to a pub, the conversation would immediately stop. If he visited anyone, he would be received with an embarrassed silence. Veiled hints and oblique questions were gradually ventured. Over the cups, coarse innuendos would be spoken, and after him would sound mocking laughter. He did not know quite what to do about it. Why, thought he, should he be accountable to the whole village for what was no man's affair but his own? A thing that was not appreciated even by the parson, who eyed him disapprovingly through his gold spectacles whenever he passed him. It tormented him, but neither did Adolf speak of it to his wife. And so they lived for some time, till one Sunday evening, the pack of tormentors, grown venturesome, presumed to call after his wife in Adolf's presence. Adolf flared up, but she put her hand on his arm. "Don't mind them. They do it so often that now I don't hear any more." "Often, do they?" Now at last he understood why she had become so silent. In a fury he made a rush to catch one of the fellows that had called out, but he vanished behind his companions, who presented a barricade with their backs. They went home and in silence turned into bed. Adolf stared into the darkness. Then he heard a hushed, subdued sound. His wife was weeping under the bedclothes. Probably she had often lain so while he slept. "Don't worry, Marie," he said gently. "Though they should all talk." But she cried on. He felt helpless and alone. Darkness stood hostile at the window, and the trees outside whispered like gossiping crones. Gently he laid his hand on his wife's shoulder. She looked at him, her eyes filled with tears. "Let me go away, Adolf. Then they will stop." She got up. The candle was still burning, and her shadow staggered large through the room. It slid across the walls. And by contrast, she was small and frail in the feeble light. She sat down on the edge of the bed and reached for her clothes. Weird and gigantic, the shadow reached out also, like a noiseless fate that had stolen in through the window out of the watchful darkness, and now, grotesque, distorted, and tittering, was mocking her every movement. Soon he would fall on his prey and drag her off into the outer, droning darkness. Adolf jumped up and plucked the white muslin curtains across the windows, as if thereby to shut off the low room against the night that stared in through the black rectangular panes with its lusting owl's eyes. The woman had already drawn on her stockings and now reached for her bodice. Then Adolf stood beside her.
"But, Marie."
She looked up and her hands dropped. The bodice fell to the floor. Adolf saw in her eyes the misery of dumb creation, the misery of a stricken animal, the forlorn, comfortless misery of those who cannot defend themselves. He put his arm about her shoulders. How soft and warm she was. How could anyone throw stones at her? Did they not both mean well? Why then should men torment and hound them so mercilessly? He drew her to him, and she yielded herself. Her arm was about his neck, and her head was on his breast. And so they both stood in their nightshirts, shivering, each sensible of the nearness of the other, each desiring to take comfort in the warmth of the other. They squatted together on the edge of the bed and said little, and when the shadows on the wall before them again began to dance, because the wick of the candle had fallen over and the flame was about to go out, Adolf, with a gentle motion of his great hand, drew his wife into bed with him, as much as to say, "Let us stay together. Let us try again." And he said, "We will go away from here, Marie." That was the only escape.
"Yes, let us go away, Adolf."
She flung herself upon him, and for the first time she now wept aloud. He held her close and kept repeating, "We'll look for a buyer tomorrow. Tomorrow morning. First thing." And in a storm of resolution, of hope, anger, and misery, he took her. So despair gave place to passion, until at last it was silenced, and the weeping grew feebler and feebler, until it gave place at last, like a child's, to exhaustion and quiet breathing. The candle was extinguished, the shadows were gone, and the woman slept, but Adolf still lay awake, brooding. During the night, the woman awoke, and feeling that she was still wearing the stockings she had pulled on when she meant to go away, she took them off and smoothed them lightly before laying them on the chair beside the bed. 2 days later, Adolf Bethke sold his house and his workshop. Soon after, he found rooms in the town and the furniture was moved in. The dog had to be left behind. But hardest of all was to say farewell to his garden, which was then just in flower. It was not easy to go away so, and Adolf did not know what might come of it. But his wife was ready and resigned. The apartment in the town is damp and dark, the stairway dirty and beset with an odor of washing, and the atmosphere heavy with neighborly hate and stuffy rooms. There is little work, but only the more time to brood. The two are not happy. It is as if all they had fled from had followed them here. Adolf squats in the kitchen and cannot understand why things do not get better. At night, after the paper has been read and the food cleared from the table, they sit down opposite each other. Then the vacancy of gloom settles down over the place until he is dazed with listening and brooding. His wife makes herself something to do. She polishes the stove, perhaps, and when he says, "Come, Marie," then she puts away her cloths and her emery paper and comes. And when, pitifully alone, he draws her down to him and whispers, "We'll do it yet," then she nods. But she continues silent. She is not gay as he would like. He does not realize that it is as much his fault as hers, that they have grown away from each other during the 4 years they have been separated, and that now they are only a burden to each other. "Say something, can't you?" he reproaches her. She looks scared, and complying, she says something. What can she talk about? When does anything ever happen here in this house, in her kitchen? But when things so stand between two people that they must talk, already it is beyond their power ever to say enough to mend them. Talk is good only when happiness is behind it. Then it runs easy and light. But where man is unhappy, what help is there then in such fickle, ambiguous things as words? They can only make matters worse. Adolf follows his wife's movements with his eyes, and behind them he sees another, a younger, light-hearted woman, the wife of his memory whom he cannot forget. Then suspicion flares up, and in exasperation he says, "Still thinking of him, are you?" And as she looks at him in surprise, he knows the injustice of what he has said. Yet for that very reason, he plunges in still deeper. "You must be. You weren't like this before. What did you come back for, then? You should have stayed with him, you know." Every word does violence to himself, but who is silent for that? He talks on until his wife retreats into the corner and stands up on the curb of the sink, out of reach of the light, and again she is crying like a child who is lost. Ah, but we are all children. Foolish, lost children, and ever the night stands around our house. He can bear it no longer. He goes out and wanders aimlessly through the streets. He stands before shop windows, but without seeing. He goes wherever there is light. Electric trams ring. Motor cars hoot past. People bump into him, and within the yellow circle of the lampposts stand the whores. They rock their fat behinds. They laugh and prod one another. "Are you happy?" he asks, and goes with them, glad to see and to hear something fresh. But afterwards, he mopes around again. He will not go home, and yet he would like to go. He makes the round of the pubs and drinks himself tight. So I find him, and listen to him, and look at him as he sits there, blear-eyed, belching his words and drinking still. Adolf Bethke, the wariest, best soldier, the most faithful comrade that has helped so many and saved so many, who was shelter and comfort and mother and brother to me so often out there, when the parachute stars hovered and the nerves were broken by long attack and threatening death. We slept side by side in the wet dugouts, and when I was sick, he would cover me. He could do everything. He was never at a loss. And now, here he is, caught in the barbed wire, tearing his hands and his face, and already his eyes have become bleared. "Ah, Ernst," he says cheerlessly. "If only we had stayed out there. At least we were together there." I do not reply. I merely glance at my coat sleeve, where are a few washed-out, reddish bloodstains. It is Vile's blood. Vile, shot down by Hale's order. So far we have come. There is war again, but no comradeship.